COVID-19 patients need your help.
If you've fully recovered from COVID-19
or unknowingly been exposed to it,
you may have the antibodies that could help COVID-19 patients recover.
Donate blood and receive testing for COVID-19 antibodies.
Visit Vitalant.org today to schedule an appointment to donate blood.
That's Vitalant.org. Help save lives and schedule your appointment at Vitalant.org.
You could help save lives.
It's the Innovation Podcast with Mark Reed Edwards and Garnett Harriman. Let's start the show.
Hi, it's Mark. Garnett and I are back with Kai Stinchcomb to continue the discussion about elder tech. We hear about the TrueLink business model, how TrueLink also helps people with disabilities, the size of the market. So without further ado, let's get back to the discussion.
So speaking of keeping your eye on the ball, what's your business model? So how do you make money?
So on the cards, you know, we make the same money other card issuers do. There's interchange, which comes out of, you know, when you swipe a credit card, the merchant gets 97 cents on the dollar, and the other 3 cents is sort of split up among the merchant bank, the acquirer, the network, the issuer, the processor, the gateway maybe, et cetera. And then we also charge a monthly fee, $10 a month. And then on our investment business, it's typically about 0.88% of assets under management. So cheap, but relatively typical for a financial advisor.
And how are you doing? I mean, are you on track with where you thought you'd be?
You know, knock on wood. Yeah, it's been an interesting and surprising journey, but I'm feeling pretty good about where we are. You know, the biggest surprises were the, you know, sort of disability community and recovery from addiction community kind of sort of found us. Mm-hmm. And so that's also, both of those are a very big part
of our
business.
That's a great segue, because my contribution to the question sort of nexus here is all about the differently abled, disabled community. So what was the eureka moment that made you think about targeting those customers with disabilities?
Well, you know, I mean, they just started signing up. Huh. And, you know, it's like one of those things where, you know, you sort of, so often the way you learn your strategy rather than devising your strategy, right? And so, you know, we sort of discovered after a little while that about a third of our new customers were people with disabilities rather than seniors. And it was sort of like, oh, well, maybe, you know, maybe we ought to be systematic about marketing to these
people. I have a saying that's been true in so many ways in my life, and it's I learned it from a mentor years ago. And he used to say, good luck is the residue of good design. Let's test that hypothesis. What was in the product offering design that was so attractive? What did you learn that was attractive to folks with disability?
Well, you know, in some cases, right, and obviously there's no sort of like quote unquote typical disability, but in some cases, especially around mental health or intellectual disability, you know, it's very similar to a family member kind of having this desire for independence, but also desire for sort of safety and, you know, sort of guardrails around the financial behavior of somebody that they have some care responsibilities for. And the interesting thing about that sort of parent of a child or adult with disabilities is that we found that there was just a much, you know, and this is like, I'm about to say something sort of terrible about the world, maybe, but there was just like a much higher level of motivation, right? That, you know, if you have a parent with Alzheimer's, you know, you didn't really plan on being a primary caregiver at this point in your life. You know, you're sort of like maybe 60, you know, peak of your career, lots of responsibilities at work, your kids maybe just got out of college, they're looking for jobs, God knows what's going on in their life. And, you know, and all of a sudden you have this sudden new and unexpected responsibility. And, you know, candidly, you know, mom's quality of life is going to be between like, you know, sort of like a 0 and a 6, but it probably isn't going to get to a 10, right? You're going to create moments of joy, but you're not going to cure her, right? You're not going to make her live another 20 years. You're not going to. And so, you know, it's sort of demoralizing. You're fighting this sort of rear guard battle, and you got 1,000 things on your plate and not enough resources. So your sort of level of like, okay, here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to dig in and find the right type of, you know, financial services tool so that she can, you know, go, you know, get pizza for her church group or whatever.
Like,
you know, you might do that and you might not. You know, you might do that and you might not. And it seems like you did pretty good there, right? You are the one that dug in, but some people don't have the bandwidth or whatever. Whereas if you are blessed with a child with autism, you are like, you have the next 20 years set aside, and it's going to be a little different than you thought. But, you know, you're going to the, you know, the dad's group, you know, at Baroni every week or whatever, you know, and you are out there looking for solutions. You talk to a special needs attorney, you talk to, you know, you sort of figure out the SSI and the Medicaid, you sort of make a care plan. You're probably talking to a nonprofit, maybe like ARC or maybe, you know, Autism Speaks, or you know, you just get a lot of resources. And so the thing we found is that it was, you know, it's much more kind of, all right, like there's this new thing, let's get this set up, you know, because you really, you just have a lot more kind of energy and optimism about your, you know, sort of ability to create a great life for this kid that you have.
So Mark and I have a staff of several hundred that actually produces research for us. And one of the interesting analogs that came up, I'm pretty sure you know that was a joke, right? So that just by way of disclaimer, yeah. I don't want anyone out there in the listening audience.
Yeah.
Just so you know, Garnett is a deadpan comic.
I'm glad you mentioned your enormous staff, because I'm sitting here in the office with my stylist and my publicist and my speaking coach.
Exactly. And the next business that we should all do together is like an entourage on demand. Like entourage sharing. Yeah. It's like Uber, but for entourages.
The Uber of entourages, yeah.
I was reading a little bit, you know, I think over the weekend, and I came across an article that made this really interesting analogy to what you're doing with the folks with disabilities in particular. And the analogy was to sports equipment makers and sports apparel makers and sports footwear makers and sports leagues all discovering that women play sports too in the late 80s, early 90s. and the size of that market, that it, you know, the women's sports apparel, sports, you know, everything market. So it feels like you're doing some of that actually. And there might be some historical analogs. Did that come up in your research?
Yeah, I think my 90% research, if I'd had the full 100, they would have run across that.
You got to get 200 like we have.
Yes, several hundred. how big, just broad stroke, how big is the market for fintech and FinServe that targets people with disabilities? How do you quantify that?
My best way to look at it is, you know, if you sort of look at USAA or TIA, which are, again, the kind of companies that's what we're trying to build, right? And you take, you know, population size and, you know, candidly, like, wealth, right? Whether that's spending power, assets, you know, whatever. So USAA has 11 million members and makes a little over $20 billion a year. TIA has 5.5 million members, so half as many, and makes about $33 billion a year, last I looked. So maybe 50% more at half the customer base. And you're like, okay, you know, our college professors, you know, sort of like six times as lucrative a customer as, you know, as a military, a member of the military. And you're like, okay, that's actually sort of plausible to me, right? It's like, you know, sort of upper middle class, lots of, you know, sort of heavy needs. And then First Republic, I think, makes probably like $20,000 a year per customer. I mean, their customers are super, super lucrative. I think, you know, for us, the sort of most of our customers are kind of at risk in one way or another. So I think that it'll probably be, you know, off the top of my head, somewhere near half as much per member as USAA. So if we get to say 10 million customers, it'll be about $10 billion a year of revenue.
Great. I think that's a reasonable logic chain to get to, you know, I don't know what you're calling it, addressable market or, you know, customer value.
And it depends on exactly kind of how we branch out. And so, you know, primarily right now we're focused on sort of more at-risk seniors. You know, if you end up sort of building something in the process that sort of, you know, helps your sort of upper middle class, no problems, vacationing in Florida seniors, you know, obviously there's more money to be made there and, you know, a little less impact. But
I think I try to sort of riff with most of our guests about things, you know, strategic things. And here's my, I don't know, prediction for your business.
Yeah.
I wonder if at some point when you're at like more of a steady state and, you know, you're throwing off loads and loads and loads of cash, you know, the way that you'd like to get to, if incremental revenues from the parents of your customers end up being a thing, you know, like a nice way to sort of goose the revenues and the profits incrementally. It'll be interesting. You know,
Yeah, you know, and I think we, you know, we basically believe, you know, if you want the sort of like the thing that when I like sort of go to bed feeling like really, really good from a business perspective, right? You think about, you know, for us, any given family will probably have once or twice in their lifetime where only we can provide the service they need. And, you know, our customer satisfaction is like at or above where USAA's is.
And you don't mean,
our customers
are
so
grateful.
You don't
mean one or two episodes. You mean one or two time periods in life, like extended multi-year.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, and that's actually really important.
Exactly.
I mean, yep.
And you think about, you know, suppose you have, you know, suppose you're Wells Fargo and there's a Wells Fargo branch across the street from a Chase branch. How many times in an average person's lifetime do they say, I got to walk out of this Chase branch and across the street to the Wells Fargo branch because Wells Fargo has what I need and Chase does not? And it's like zero. So, you know, if once in a lifetime I get the customer and zero times in a lifetime Wells Fargo or Chase gets the customer, then I, you know, yeah. I like where I'm sitting.
No, absolutely. Absolutely. So this and so this next question comes with a warning, right? Remember, Mark's expertise is like a marketing and branding guru. But this is something that's fascinating to me because I noticed that you have a particular syntax and a particular jargon about how you talk about your customers, and probably well rehearsed from a shitload of presentations that you've made and whatever. So.
And the research team.
90 and we're hiring.
No, it's not me coming up with
10 openings.
What's different / better about how you market your services to differently abled customers? You know, marketing, branding, any sort of tactical thing in the marketing mix.
Yeah. Well, you know, I guess the thing that I would say, and this is it's genuinely difficult, right? But we can't cure your mom's Alzheimer's, right? We don't purport to make your life easy. It may not be delightful setting up this product. You know, you might fight with her about, you know, her level of independence. You might, you might go to sleep crying the day you set up our product, right? This is, okay, see, look, I'm a great marketer. You might go to sleep crying the day you set up our product. But, you know, the brand promise is that we will always understand you. We will always understand the situation. We will not ask dumb questions. We will not, you know, like you said, like the alerts that you're getting from PayPal, like we just won't do that because we know your mom is like getting ice cream for the church group. Of course she is. That's who your mom is. And we can't change that much about her life, but we can understand the situation and be a good partner for that. And, you know, and it's complicated because, you know, obviously the situations we address are very widely divergent, right? And so you might have somebody who is, you know, where it's basically, you know, somebody who's 10 years sober and just as a sort of like extra safeguard, you know, as part of a long-term commitment to sobriety, has set it up so that on any large cash withdrawal, it texts their sponsor, right? And
okay,
that level of life situation
right
is so...
I love that one.
Right?
Yeah.
And that is so different from somebody who, you know, maybe they're, you know, the dad who has coffee once a week with his army buddies and literally every other purchase is him getting scammed. And, you know, for example, one's a very positive story and the other one, you're like, okay, look, like, this situation is not good, but we've preserved something worth preserving here. We've done something that matters. But, you know, from a marketing perspective, it's just you kind of can't get it wrong.
Yeah.
And so, you know, if you ask our 90-person research team, it's like, you know, all 90 of them are working on one document at a time because, you know, it's everybody's got to look at it and everybody says, okay, you know, is this really right? Are we really capturing the essence of this? But, you know, we're just not. You know, we just can't like write blog posts about like, you know, more bars and more places or whatever.
But I think it really takes a really keen understanding of who it is that you're serving, whether and so that you kind of have empathy for what they're going through. You're not just in this to fleece them. You know, you're not just in it to make money from them. You're in it to help them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it really comes across. And I think it really comes across in every interaction.
Yeah.
Very cool.
So, Kai, you wrote a piece that I read online in which you said that charging for TrueLink initially hurt your company but ultimately saved it. And I was thinking about something in my career back at the turn of the century. I was working for a company that did intranet services online, and we were ad supported. And then NASDAQ blew up, and no one was spending money on advertising. And people thought, well, the company's probably going to go out of business, but we decided to start a subscription service where we actually charged a subscription and you'd pay $10 a month, $20 a month, whatever it was. And that actually saved the company. So can you tell us about your experience starting to charge for TrueLink?
Yeah, well, so you know, basically we saw a lot of people, Coin, Plastic, Simple, Final, Clinkle. There was one called Astros or Swipe. We were part of a generation of new specialized debit card offerings, right? And we saw, you know, Simple, for example, which, you know, had a good outcome, made money for themselves, made money for their investors, but I guess it was BBVA that acquired them, you know, just wrote off its goodwill from the acquisition, you know, sort of realizing basically that there was no way that Simple ever could have made money. Yeah. And in a way that they got lucky, because this thing about acquiring millennial customers happened to be something that BBVA believed also at the same time as they needed an exit, you know. But, and again, like, I sincerely don't want to trash talk them. When I say I don't want to trash talk Wells Fargo, I'm not being honest, but you know, they really did kind of go the distance and build something that people really wanted. But you know, we saw this, and our view was that, you know, we weren't going to get lucky with BBVA, and that wasn't our plan anyway. And we wanted to build something that would stand on its own as an independent business forever. And basically, you know, if what we're solving is a problem that is, you know, again, a problem that you cry about, right? It's a serious problem. Mm-hmm. Taking away your dad's ability to go get coffee with his army buddies, telling your mom she can't buy the ice cream at the church social anymore. You know, the fear of relapse, right? That's a real problem. And if we can't persuade you that addressing that problem is worth $10 a month, then, you know, then either we aren't delivering or we aren't telling our story. But if you have the problem that we're solving and we're doing a good job, then $10 a month should be like a no-brainer. And so it made it hard at first, right? Because Simple and Final and Coin, you know, had these like 100,000 person waiting lists, but, you know, kind of none of those customers ended up being passionate about the product. They had sold it on it being free rather than on it being valuable.
Did you do any studies on, you know, price elasticity, how much you could charge or how little, or, you know, what drove the decision?
You know, we liked it for its simplicity, but, you know, candidly, the decision was actually primarily based on, you know, like regulatory scrutiny around high fees for credit cards. Yeah. You know, and so you know, if there was going to be elasticity, it would be actually, you know, the optimum would be higher, right? If we said, you know, is it worth $17 a month for your dad to be able to go get coffee?
Yeah.
You know, it probably is, right? But, you know, $17 a month for a credit card, you know, you start to have the OCC saying, you know, why is this the most expensive credit card in America, targeting a sort of vulnerable population? Right. And, you know, again, we didn't want to be the most expensive credit card in America either, right? It's kind of not who we are.
Yeah.
But we, you know, we probably would be making money at more money at 17 than we are at 10.
Yeah. Yeah.
So we just set something that, you know, in summary, we did no experimentation. We just set something that felt reasonable and stuck with it for the next decade.
Yeah. And sometimes those are the best decisions you can make, just ones that seem to make sense, right?
I just hope.
I just hope. I don't know.
The folks at Amex Platinum that I use for all of my traveling end up making it $10 a month.
Yeah, that'd be good.
Well, you know, I'm sure they're listening right now.
God willing,
cut your fees,
Mazel Tov.
Cut your fees.
So, well, this has been a really interesting discussion. I want to end with a bit of a flourish, because I also read something you wrote about blockchain, and I'm interested in what you think about blockchain.
Yeah, so you know, this is one of those funny things where I, you know, as Silicon Valley had this moment of sort of collective hysteria over the course of 2018, you know, in theory, and I was like right in the middle of it, right? All of the fintech, you know, happy hours and so on. I was the person that should have needed this, right? Mm-hmm. I was doing handling transactions. There was a transparency and record keeping aspect. There was a fraud protection aspect. We were transferring money among multiple accounts, verifying identities. So if there was, you know, if there was any use case, I would have had it, right? And I'm just sitting there like, you know, how, you know, I couldn't figure out what it was for. And it's funny, so then I started kind of asking people, and everyone I talked to was like, oh, you know, I know blockchain is going to change everything, but I just can't for the life of me use it in my company, right? And so you have, you know, you're sort of talking to somebody at BBVA, which has this like sort of like, they're a leader in blockchain, you know, and like the, you know, the person who's responsible for that, and BBVA is a for example here, I'm actually talking about Capital One, but I don't want to use their name. You know, they're like, you know, that person's like, oh yeah, you know, like I'm under pressure from my boss to spend money on it so that we can say we have a blockchain initiative, but like I can't figure out what it's for, but I'm sure like, you know, Walmart with its like lettuce tracking initiative, you know, is totally gonna, you know, that's what I think that's really good. And everybody thought somebody else had a use case for it. I mean, this lettuce tracking thing at Walmart is like the stupidest thing on God's great earth. They try, you know, when RFID was new, they literally had a lettuce tracking system that they built that was going to be equally revolutionary. And then they mothballed it because nobody wanted to enter accurate data about the lettuce tracking. And so this is like, I was thinking about writing a sequel. This is great. You guys love this. The Last Remains of the Blockchain, because I wanted to, you know, it's fun, right? Because you know, my prediction is Walmart's going to mothball that thing in the next 12 months. It just makes no sense. But yeah, so, you know, there I was like, basically some guy on a couch. And I was like, I don't think anyone needs this. And so I like wrote this thing in a Google Doc, sent it to a couple of friends. They were like, that's like too long for an op-ed and too short to be substantive. If you want to like write a book about blockchain, like divide it up into chapters and explore each of the use cases. If you want to write an op-ed, this is five times as long as it should be.
Yeah.
Like nobody's going to read this stupid thing. And so I wrote it in like March or April and like just never pressed publish because basically all the feedback I got was negative. And I didn't really have time to clean it up. And I'm not part of the blockchain industry. I don't really have a dog in this fight. And then finally, there I am, like the day after Christmas, sitting in a memory care unit, just kind of hanging out on the couch. And honestly, in a memory care unit, the conversation's pretty slow. And so it's like, I can participate in the conversation and just like copy and paste this stuff from a Google Doc and post it on the Medium. And then, you know, like 11 million views later,
yeah,
you know, I've become this sort of like internet sensation. And so my girlfriend has told me that if it turns out I'm wrong, I can take her last name, you know, but you know, I still haven't seen anything that it's for.
Right. It's, you know, an interesting technology. Maybe blockchain for millennials is the thing.
Yeah.
No,
right.
No. You know, millennials order in the military.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. Order food at your desk in, you know,
with a blockchain.
Okinawa. You know, and an interesting thing, you know, Facebook is rolling out this blockchain thing in India, and that, you know, that has scale, right? That's real. And I'm like, okay, that's, you know, that's pretty cool, right? But you remember Facebook credits? Like they already have an internal system for, you know, exchanging made up currency over Messenger among its users. So this system already exists, has existed for a decade. And then they mothballed it a couple of years ago because nobody wanted it. And, you know, you sort of say, okay, having a distributed ledger, but I think it's going to be actually an internal distributed ledger, i.e., you know, a not distributed ledger or you know, just a, you know, a ledger, I guess you would say, which is how Facebook credits ran. But this will just be like a ledger in which there's like a bunch of cool hash codes, I think, you know, or it's going to be a genuinely distributed ledger, in which case if your Facebook account gets hacked, your wallet gets emptied. Which is like, you know, that's what banking was like in 1600.
Right.
You know, it was terrible, right? And you have to like hire guys with swords to protect your bank account. I mean, you know, literally, right? You know, the Knights Templar was actually an international banking organization because that's what you needed.
Yeah. And I think Wells Fargo was a stagecoach.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Right. And I mean, actually, it's remarkable that so on the Wells Fargo stagecoach, there's two guys, right? There's the driver and the person sitting in the passenger seat guarding the box of silver or gold, right? And that guy is riding shotgun, yeah. Riding shotgun.
Millennials in the
origin
military.
Of that phrase.
By the way, the thing about USAA that always has impressed me, and no one in my extended family,
well, you know, you're gonna
USAA,
need that now, right?
In my nuclear family,
shotgun.
But
cold
like,
storage.
You know, business partners, yeah, from exactly. The past and friends.
Yeah, well, Kai, this has been a great chat.
Stuff.
I really,
you know,
appreciate
I've had
you joining
all
us.
These contacts with USA, and
you know,
I'm just blown away.
MX, $10
it's close, as far as I can go, it's close to 100% customer approval. You know, it's just, it's astonishing.
And on that happy note.
It's astonishing.
Have a good one.
You too. Thanks to Kai for being here. In the weeks ahead, we'll chat with experts Bruno Aguiar about the world of esports and Mark Gallagher about innovation in the world of F1. We also have chats planned on facial recognition and lots of other subjects, so stay with us.
Thanks for joining Garnett and Mark on the Innovation Podcast. Visit innovationpodcast.co to subscribe and listen to other episodes.